Welcome to The Colorcast, a show about color grading, color science, and post-production. We are the Coloristos. I'm Jason Myers, a colorist in Los Angeles.
And I'm Juan Salvo, a colorist in New York City.
And I'm Josh Petock, a colorist in Los Angeles as well. And this week, what we wanted to talk about, after our long hiatus from the summer, we want to talk a lot about grading for television and broadcast TV, what tools we use, and how you work on these really tough deadlines when you're up against air and when you need to just get it done. So
the very thing that's kept us apart all these many
that's
months.
That's right, yeah.
Well, I guess what have you guys been working on recently? Like, Josh, what describe some of the shows you've been working on.
So as of late, I've been working on shows for sci-fi, a couple of shows. One of them was called Heroes of Cosplay. And the other one is a show called Ghost Mine, and they're both pretty tough. It's not easy, but you know, you do what you can with what time you have, and that's always the case for TV.
Yeah, I think the thing about television is like you're always up against a deadline. Yeah, and that's kind of it's a good thing because it keeps people from kind of going nuts. At a certain point, you really have to go, okay, well, we're out of time for this, we need to get it out the door. And and it also really hones your kind of your triage skills. You know, it's all about making decisions immediately about what you have time to address and what the payoff of that addressing that
right.
is. You know, it's about sort of the most reward for the time that you're putting into it. You have a finite amount of time. You want to get the most you can out of
right.
it.
Right. Get the heart beating before you perform plastic surgery, as we like to say.
Exactly.
I think it depends on the show too.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. That's true.
Sometimes the plastic surgery is the most important thing you can do. But I think like actually really valuable skills as a colorist is, you know, your clients are paying you for your time, but what they're really paying for is your expertise in getting something done efficiently and quickly. And sometimes they don't know the difference between something that is going to make a minor difference for the quality of the show, but will take up a lot of time, versus something that takes very little time or just a little bit of time, but makes a big difference for the quality of the show.
Yeah, that's a good point, Juan. It's almost like you have to pick your battles, kind of like you're saying, with all of the various things you could do. You know, I would say almost 50% of it is not even going to be your color skills, but just your prioritization skills. And that's actually something that I learned quite a bit recently, because I was helping Josh's company out with two of their shows. And, you know, their goal is, you know, pretty ambitious. I guess, what is it, Josh? They want us to get a show done every 2 days, you know, with a little bit of leeway each week for anything that spills over, like getting approvals and things like that. But really, you see it in the morning. By that evening, on the first day, you should have your first major color pass. You get a morning for touch-ups, and then that afternoon is review and lay off the tape, you know.
Right.
So it's quick. You got to turn it around rapidly. And I guess, Juan, you have a ton of time in broadcast, especially like early on, didn't you?
Oh, I did a lot of I started out in TV news, actually. So I you know, I had deadlines that would make you guys blush. Like I started out kind of editing stuff for air, where I would have, 20 seconds to cut something. I was supposed to run 40 seconds, you know, like I was cutting stuff basically live onto air. As close to that. There's that scene in Broadcast News where like the editor's like running the tape out as the anchor's introducing and they're all like, Bobby, Bobby. That was me, you know. It was like, Juan, Juan, as I'm like running the tape out. And I think that experience is actually has been really formative and really kind of instructive. I think the skills that you develop under those deadlines are really, really valuable, even when you don't have the incredibly tight deadlines. When you're trying to give your clients value for their time, it's really good to know, to have an understanding of how long something takes and how much reward there is for
yeah.
that time.
And I really think that you build in some really good instincts as well. You just know, you just see something, you say, this is exactly how we need to go, and you implement it. You just do, and you mm-hmm. you feel your way around as to what you do, and you can't waver on how something has to get done. You have a deadline; it just needs to get done.
Yeah, there are situations where being confident is more important than being right sometimes.
Yeah, I could see that. And just being, just making a decision either way, you know?
Yeah, because a lot of the things we do are kind of subjective, and there isn't a real right or wrong for some things in color. But having some confidence and being decisive about something in a situation where you're under a time constraint is going to make everything else faster, because the less you have, the less you second guess yourself, or the less your client is second guessing yourselves. And you're, in the case of television for you guys, it's like the director or the producer or whoever's in the room with you. You know, if you have some confidence and you say, you know, this is the right white balance, or this is this camera should be our reference camera or master camera for the picture, and we should match to this camera, and you can say that with some level of confidence, that's actually really valuable for them, because that's one less thing for them to sort of second guess themselves about.
Right.
And it helps the whole process move faster.
We've had a lot of questions about people doing broadcast work for the first time. What do you guys think are the key things that they need to focus on?
I would say the first one, the most important thing is find a way to give yourself more time than you think you're going to need. Because certainly more than your client is asking for. You're going to, you know, if it's a learning experience, you're not going to have the muscle memory that, for example, Josh has with the tablet and the little interface. You're not going to have that expertise to really maximize your efficiency. And so an experienced producer will say, you know, this should take 2 days, but, you know, that takes 2 days for somebody who's been doing it for a couple of years. Give yourself more time than that. Plan extra time. Plan to, you know, ask your client to get you the cut earlier, to get you conformed the day before, so you can conform it and not include that time, not have that time take away from the time that you're going to need in the room. Plan extra time for deliverables. I think that's the most underestimated period of time for television, is how long it actually takes to make that master tape. It doesn't take, you know, 40 minutes for a 40-minute show. It really takes 2.5 hours for a 40-minute show. By the time you get the tape striped, check the time code, make sure it's inserted correctly. As you're laying off, inevitably you're going to find that one mistake you got to stop and fix, that typo in the lower third, or the chyron that didn't come up, or the whatever. All those things, they're tough to account for ahead of time, but you need to factor them into your plan.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point, too. One of the things I learned from Josh early on is Josh has this term called banking time.
Yeah.
It's really amazing. Like, so when I first got to when I first started on the shows that I was working on this summer, there was a lot going on. There was a lot that I needed to do to get up to speed. Actually, I was really fortunate. I had Josh and I had two amazing AEs that were really helpful. And so one of the things that was important, though, is I really, especially as I was being given this opportunity, did not want to be the reason that we were behind. And so there were many days early on when I worked quite late. So let's say that I'd get in at 9. I worked until, say, 9 or 10 or 11 on a number of my shows to get ahead, because Josh sort of mentioned this idea, get ahead of your shows. That way, if things come up that you can't control, you have time to resolve them. And the thing that's interesting is that it was really nice when we did have issues, because of the fact that I'd put in those extra hours on a number of early evenings, we got several days ahead on the shows that I was working on, and we did run into issues. But what could have been really painful was something we were able to take in stride because of that. And it wasn't just me. Everybody else was working their butt off too. But the thought was that if you're getting into a show for the first time, you know, don't leave at 6 o'clock. Get as far as you can, and as long as, you know, your eyes and everything will hold up, put in those extra moments in order to get to a really great stopping point. And then later on, your life will be, it will go from being incredibly stressful to being something that you can really deal with nicely because of the fact that you put in those extra time, that extra time early on.
Yeah. And I think part of it too is just being proactive too. Even if a cut isn't locked, is there anything that you can do on it to get ahead? Can you get some actual hero frames that you can get an idea of how scenes look like? You know, it's all about how early you get into that stuff too.
Yeah. I like that, the idea of the concept of the banking time. I think that's, I was kind of getting at that same idea before, but That's a really great way of expressing it. I think any time that you can bank, and that goes all the way through. It also, you know, time that you can bank on the back end is time saved as well. So if you can, get extra time to deliver the international version instead of having to deliver that right away, you know, like that can save you as well. If you're not, if you run into a problem and you don't have to deliver that international version right away, you can prioritize the domestic version, get that out the door, and then start to worry about the international. Whereas if you're trying to do both versions simultaneously, you can miss both deadlines.
And you know what's really interesting too? Tell me what you guys have found with this, but you know, we did these HDCAM SR laybacks, and it was interesting. You know, I guess after my first or second one, one of the assistant editors just mentioned that, yeah, this is actually the backup. What we do for a lot of our shows now is FTP up a DNX HD master, I believe it was, and this tape is just sent as backup. Are you guys finding that the file is, you know, sort of replacing tape as the primary deliverable?
No, I mean, I still see tape as the primary, for television, I still see tape as the primary deliverable, but I've seen situations where we've done ProRes deliverables as a kind of... alternate, or I can think of one situation where we did a ProRes layoff as a way to just expedite things and get, because we were running out of time, so we needed to run it. I'm on 45th Street in Midtown East, and we had to run it over to basically 47th in Midtown West to the broadcaster, and like physically just grab the drive and ran it over for broadcast.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the file-based deliveries as well is it's not always accounting for other things that you may need to add to it, like captioning, or I know I was talking to Juan about VChip encoding and maybe alternate audio tracks if you have that as well, like SAP. So it's...
Or if you need to do an insert.
Yeah.
If you have to fix something and do an insert, that's a whole new export in file land. It's a little 30-second gesture in tape land.
Right. If you just figured out after you had made the file that you needed to change a subtitle to have a period in it or something like that, you have to re-export the whole file.
There's a lot of times where a file export can happen faster than real time, so you're not totally at the consequence of you know, what a tape would require, which would be real time. So I mean, I don't know. Do you think that tape will echo into infinity, or do you believe that at some point, you know, files will? I mean, it has to happen, right?
Tape's demise has to happen. I mean, even with film, like we're in a situation where we don't have a really good kind of long term archival. I think that's probably less critical for television, but you know, if you're looking at a 5-year shelf life, you know, you can back something up to LTO tape. That's still tape. But like, you know, that SR tape has a 5-year shelf life for sure, has a 10-year shelf life, probably has a 25, 30-year shelf life. I mean, in terms of usability, not just in terms of the mechanism will last, the tape mechanism lasts even longer than that. Where hard drives don't. You know, like if you have a hard drive sitting on a shelf for 5 years and then you start it up, you're risking failure right at that specific moment. So I mean, that's a major issue for films, for television, is the long-term archival of these digital formats. How do we preserve this material long term? You know, film, there are films that have never seen a film print that have had their backup encoded as data onto film stock. And because they thought that would be a safer archival format than a drive or an LTO tape. I think there's still a good reason to kind of master to SR, you know, at least for the foreseeable future. But how much longer that is, I don't know. Probably until we solve the issue of long-term archival.
Well, what about that idea of there's a new Sony deck that's going to come out, the SR Media player and recorder?
Sure.
So yep. That's yep. Going to be a lot like a tape. It's going to act like a tape, but it's actually going to be to, like, flash media, right?
Yeah, but, I mean, that doesn't solve the long-term archive because that media is very, very expensive. So you wouldn't grab that media and store it in a warehouse for 20 years, you know. So it doesn't solve the long-term storage issue. It's a tricky issue. Like, there isn't an easy answer. I think you're, like, particularly for, like, the international deliverables, like, we've done a couple series where we've had to, like, deliver, you know, international versions that get distributed for years and years and years. And, you know, like, they're still making new deals and selling to new territories. And, I mean, for, like, a five-year-old show. And so they always ask for, they were, at the time they were asking for HD cam. Now they ask for HD cam SR, but they always want tape.
What about, I know Josh, in your new, bay that they built for you recently, you've got a HyperDeck, in your rack there. I guess, is there a way you're going to try to creep into using that, for certain things?
We've actually used it a couple of times on different series, to some success. I mean, it's worked great. It does. The cool thing about using a HyperDeck is that it can pass through the same SDI chain as you're sending to the SR deck as well. So that means it can go through a legalizer. It can go through all the same channels that you're usually sending a file to, which is great. And it's also in real time, or you could do it simultaneously as you're making a tape, which is also great. But the only issues that we have with it are being able to add captioning to it. It actually strips out the captioning and puts it as a file next to the ProRes or DNX HD file. And what else was there? The time code accuracy we're still trying to work out. But other than that, I mean, the look of it, the workflow, everything is pretty solid. If somebody was asking for a file, which a lot of networks still do ask for a DNX HD file or a ProRes file, I think it's great for that.
So, Josh, you're using Symphony primarily. I guess you've been actually using Symphony for going on, what, like 10 years now? Are you finding that is still as awesome as it has ever been? Or what are you doing now in terms of the tools you're using?
Well, the color tools in Symphony are kind of lacking, but the basic things are there. And you can do some of the same things like windowing and tracking and even secondaries. They're just not as good as say, what you would get in Resolve. But they get the job done. The thing that you really gain from Symphony is the relational color corrector, being able to say, I want every one of these interviews to be colored the same way, or I want to take all the color from this sequence and apply it to this sequence. Those are the things that it really excels at. And also being in an editorial workflow. I mean, it's if somebody says, I need you to trim this shot right away and move this, or I want, you know, this to end at this frame, then you can easily, it's a great editing application. So you could do that as well. But I really do think that some of the things that Resolve has built into it lately that address it being an online editor are big, big improvements. And I can see them making inroads.
I think that's a really valuable factor in favor of Symphony still, is like, it's a zero work conform. Here, going from a media composer environment, you're just literally just opening the bin, and that's it. Your conform is done. Where, you know, Resolve, even though it's improved and always improving, it's not a zero work conform. If you have certain plugins that are not going to be available in Resolve, those aren't going to translate. Titles might have to be, you know, modified or redone or updated or brought in. But Resolve 10 makes huge, leaps and bounds improvements in that regard, and that the editorial functions in Resolve make it really much more viable for that kind of work. Like, you can do, like you said, you can tweak a cut in Resolve instead of having to go back to editorial and export and reconform and do that whole process.
Yeah, I have a sort of an interesting situation. I've been using Resolve for about, say, 3 or 4 years now. And then in the recent past, I've been actually working with Media Composer for probably about 3 or 4 years. But as far as Symphony color grading goes, I actually got into that, you know, fairly recently. And the one thing I'll say is that there are a lot of people that have been using Symphony for quite a while. And I'm sure that, you know, there's always a fun aspect to switching to something else. And so a lot of people are looking at Resolve. But what I'll say is, a person going the opposite a direction who has a lot of time and with resolve. I actually respect Symphony a lot now. You know, I would say that in terms of fast turnaround environments and situations where you really need a concise set of tools to get a number of things done, for instance, setting exposure, you know, highlights and shadows, going through and doing color correction on something that might be, say, oversaturated, or attempting to get things, make things legal, and then the ability to make things look quite good within the bounds of the time allowed. Symphony actually is kind of wonderful, and the relational color grading is very nice. There are certain things that it does not tackle, so it's not the end-all be-all, but it is a huge help when you come along a certain set of shots that came from the same media later on in your timeline, and they are largely there. And so essentially, you know, you can go and touch up certain shots that might have most of the grade, but let's say the highlights for some reason in a shot need to be addressed a little differently, and you can do that with sort of another layer on top. But what I will say is I do believe that the bar is getting raised, and that's what I think you ran into a bit, Josh, where you're getting opportunities now for certain shows you're doing to do a more cinematic grade. And while Symphony is really wonderful, there's going to be a situation now where if people are looking at TV shows as requiring the kind of polish that, say, a House of Cards or Breaking Bad require, I think you're going to need to figure out solutions with some of these, you know, more capable, pure thoroughbred color grading tools. And that's where things like Resolve will make a lot of inroads. And then Baselight and Filmmaster are really popular too, because of the fact that they work really well with, say, an Avid Conform.
Right. Like, I know that I dragged Jason in one day and I said, look at how many steps it takes to make a window in Symphony. And it was like literally about 7 or 8 steps. And so it's one of those things where, sure, you can do it. But if it takes that many steps for every window that you want to create, then it's not really, you're not going to use it.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, the number of times that you would actually use it are so few because the cost, the time cost, and the workflow cost is so huge, right? The bulk of television is produced like this, but then there are also, you know, kind of prime time high end TV that gets colored at, you know, major shops. Like the kind of narrative television does already get that kind of cinematic workflow. You know, they go into a Telecine session, or they shoot on film, or they shoot Alexa, but they go to a Baselight or a Resolve, or, you know, or in the case of like closed shops, you know, they might be Quantel based. They'll go to a Pablo,
right,
or a Rio.
The funny thing is I'm getting like questions that honestly I'd say almost surprise me out of this industry. Like, hey, should we shoot this show in log? And what can we do to, you know, pull a secondary on this and throw a window on that? And so it's interesting that people are becoming more educated in this stuff too. So there,
I think you see that in color. It's like, you know, I think a lot of kind of established colorists are scared of Resolve becoming so cost effective, or like it's free basically. But I think that there's something of value there where people get their hands on the software, they recognize the capabilities. They also recognize they're not the most apt user for those capabilities. They realize the value of going to somebody that specializes in this, or having their specialist use these tools. They see the value of these assets. Like, they go, well, shooting log, for example, makes for a reality TV series with a time crunch, it may not always be the best choice. But if they go, well, we get a couple more stops of latitude and things generally look better if we shoot log, let's budget in more time for a color session. Let's budget in time to make dailies. Let's figure out a workflow where we can make this work. And it might be a higher cost in time or in money or in resources or whatever. They learn the value of that extra step. The same sort of logic can apply to going to a Resolve session instead of doing a Symphony. The Symphony's worked for years, but you know what? Well, we can do a lot more. We can do a lot finer detail work. We can get a lot better results in a Resolve session than we can in a Symphony session. Let's find the extra 6 hours for the show to take it into Resolve instead of doing it in Symphony.
Right. I mean, sometimes, though, I would say that you could probably gain some of that time back in Resolve with things like that we don't have in Symphony, like the light box. can quickly bang through a scene and find a bunch of the same shots and then move on. What I think is great about Resolve is it gets you through that first pass very quickly. So an initial like grade on the whole project can get done relatively quickly if you use things like the new split screen, I think is really great, and being able to group shots together so that you kind of fit, you're doing something similar like that you would do in a symphony related color workflow. So you can right. kind of make it do the things that you want, but you just have to plan for it, I would say.
Yeah, I think there's also, I think you'll also find yourself in a situation where you're doing things more complex than you would otherwise, or you're finessing more than you would otherwise, just because you have the availability at your fingertip to do it.
Right.
So maybe the time stays the same or it goes up a little bit, but the quality goes up significantly.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. In terms of, the quality, do you think that the timeline for moving to things like Quad HD are getting, closer and closer where, sort of this higher end color grading tool set is going to be required for the fact that we're all going to be looking at four times the pixels? I mean, I guess HD will probably be around for quite a while, but what do you guys think about that?
Josh, do you still deliver shows in SD?
Oh yeah, we still have a couple of shows. Well, actually, one or two shows. We still lay off to DigiBeta. I mean,
I think it depends on the kind of the level, the tier of programming. But I think there's going to be a lot of television being mastered in HD for years and years and years.
And we never saw a reality show in stereo.
That's an interesting point too.
Oh. 3D reality show? Dude, you the logistics of... Well, you know what? Panasonic did have that, like, 3D camera that was, like, a single lens.
Yeah.
Like, not a single lens. It was dual lens, but it was, like, a single camera system. You could have seen that. I'll tell you, I worked on a TV series where, in the pre-production phase, they were looking at maybe shooting some stuff in 3D because there was a potential sponsor that would have wanted to be able to show content in 3D. So they did talk about it at one point.
Yeah, I kind of think about it like...
It never happened.
Like, let's say Netflix gets into delivering 4K or Super HD and they need a lot of content. And they say, well, mm-hmm. let's have a show like Survivor or something in 4K and it will drive a lot of people to subscribe to our network. Then I would kind of believe it. But, I mean, I think that... 4K and stereo are a little bit different too, because I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but you don't have to change the way you cut 4K. Yeah, you'll be able to see more detail, but if you make something too cutty in stereo, you're going to make people throw up. So,
I think, well, there's a lot of rules in stereo work. Like, it's not just the cuttiness, but it's also the changes in ocular distance,
right,
and the depth in the shot and all the, like, there's a lot of things that could make somebody puke from 3D. It's not just cuttiness. It's a lot of other things too. I remember, the little bit of 3D stuff that we've done, there were certain shots where, like, if I tweak the convergence a certain way, I could instantly give somebody a headache. Like, I could have you take off a pair of glasses. I could turn a couple of knobs. I could have you put that glasses on and you would immediately get a headache, like in a split second. And I made that mistake a couple of times. Like, what the first lesson you learn working in 3D, if you're doing convergence and kind of stereoscopic work, the first thing you learn is you don't put on the glasses until you feel like you've got the convergence in the right place, until you've got things kind of set up properly. Because if you're wearing those glasses the entire time, you're just going to kill your eyes.
Right.
And the other thing, too, is given the amount of work that 3D requires, you really need to have a payoff somehow, an enhancement of the program. And if you're doing something like reality television, it's just so hard to predict where that payoff is going to be. If you have a scripted, you know, narrative television show or something like a feature, you know, you can really build in something where that helps the story. Right. But, man, in Run and Gun and DocuFollow and all that stuff, it's just too unpredictable, I think. You know?
Well, let me
– Well, I mean, I could see situations where, like, on the makeover shows, for example, it'd be kind of cool to have 3D and, you know, might add something to it. Like, you know, if you're shooting that room that's been made over and you show the before and after and it's in 3D yeah. and you see, like, all the depth and all the detail really brings stuff out.
Well, let me take it full circle now, too, because if you think about it, okay, so if we agree that Avid is kind of leading the charge in reality and docu-series and stuff like that. Let's say at some point they decide to go 4K. Avid dump DS. We have no 4K output options. And they don't really have that much in terms of their development staff. So what would happen in that case? Would they have to go to something else to deliver the show or?
Yeah. So right now, if you're cutting an Avid and you need to deliver 4K, you have to go somewhere else. You have to go to DS or you have to go to Resolve or Baselight or whatever else or Flame in order to deliver that show. There used to be really hardware dependent reasons for that and software dependent reasons for that, for the limitations in Media Composer and in Symphony. The hardware dependent limitations have been removed. And so now it's just a matter of the software being enabled to support higher frame sizes. There have been rumors for years that they were going to do it, and they've just haven't done it yet. Now that they've killed DS, maybe that means that they're ready to pull the trigger and have resolution-independent timelines, but they don't yet.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's such a shame, I think, is that, you know, a lot of people are really comfortable with, say, Media Composer and Symphony. Boy, I'll tell you, like, as far as color goes, if in the Symphony color corrector they were to just add one more tab for shapes, and then, you know, I guess I would really find useful a true HSL, you know, based qualifier, you know, rather than sort of the hue-based qualifier, the vector-based qualifier that's in there now. You know, Symphony is not super far from being even more complete if it just had those two tabs. And then if they were able to solve the greater than HD issue, you know, they would be set for the next, you know, 8 years. You know, and I think that the tried and trueness of it, the track record is a really comforting thing to people who just cannot upset the flow of work through their facility. But because of this HD issue and then also the idea that the Symphony color tools haven't evolved too much, it's really forcing quite a massive possible reshuffle for a lot of companies that can be unnerving if you're a post-soup right now, I think. You know, and I think a lot of people feel like things are very up in the air in terms of how a lot of television gets done, you know, coming up in the future, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I would add to that, too, is that they need real panel support, too. That's the other thing that's really lacking for Avid. I mean, the MC Color is fine, but I think that there's a lot of room for improvement.
What about, like, say, the Baselight Editions plugin? Josh, you and I have been playing with it. I know, Juan, you've played with it quite a bit. Is that going to, especially with the tangent element support, is that going to offer, you know, let's say at least 80% of what people need, or is it just really for those who, say, have a Baselight at the end and would like to do some pre-grading?
I'd be more curious, rather than the tangent elements, like, I'd be more curious to see what the Film Light's own slate interface is going to do with that plugin, because the big limiting factor for it right now is that the memories, like, don't really exist, like a still store, you know, saving grades and then carrying them from one clip to the next is kind of tricky and not intuitive at this point. And so having that functionality would be great. I know that Film Light has made some suggestions to Avid and ways they could improve their AVX plugin infrastructure, and some of those would be really, really useful, like, you know, being able to, for example, do the do the relational color corrections within the plugin, as opposed to, you know, so basically you would apply a plugin, the Baseline plugin, and do the relational color corrections within that plugin would be really powerful and something that Avid would have to implement. So I think ultimately it's a strategy decision on the part of Avid. It's kind of unfortunate that they seem to be in the position that they're in, which is not a particularly strong position in the marketplace right now. They don't seem to be really kind of innovating in an aggressive way. And in that sense, I think they're kind of fallen behind quite a bit. But by that same token, I don't think there's really a clear venue for people to go to that's going to be as effective as the Avid workflow is today, right? So television is a weird medium in that I think, well, it's not weird. I think maybe it's indicative of the kind of the whole industry, but there is sort of a growing gap between the very high-end workflows for like episodic narrative television and the kind of the more everyday workflows for the broad, you know, cross-section of sort of reality or docu-style television, which is the bulk of television that's produced. And I think the needs for one are not necessarily like the needs for the other. So the high-end narrative stuff is really well served with like cutting in whatever they want, and it's usually Media Composer, and then finishing outside of Media Composer. So they generally finish in Baselite or Resolve for color and do their conform in yet another application and or Smoke or whatever, and then do their deliverables from that. Whereas with episodic, it's really about efficiency and what's the most efficient and effective solution going to be. And so that sometimes leads to different choices.
Yeah, and it's interesting even with like new networks like Netflix or Amazon or any of those markets, they want like all of the shows at the same time. So it's not like a weekly schedule. So, I mean, I was reading about how they were doing, Arrested Development, and how they said, oh yeah, we want every episode next week. And they were like, what? So,
well, I mean, but they had like, you know, months and months of warning. It wasn't, it wasn't like, but Josh, personally, like, would you prefer a weekly delivery, or would you prefer, like, if you know, for example, that you're going to need to deliver 11 episodes of Ghost Mine in 3 weeks, doesn't that give you some efficiency that you can, for example, you can do all your interviews at once and you can do all your whatever at once? Like, the idea would be obviously that the shows would get locked earlier as well. Like, you wouldn't be locking one show a day. You'd be locking, you know, 13 shows 3 weeks out.
To me, it's the same difference, really, I guess, now that I think about it. It's they all need to get done, and they all need to get done at a certain time. I think that the problem with it is there are certain elements that are missing from shows. So maybe it would be a benefit because you could leapfrog over to other things while, they're resolving other issues on earlier shows. So sure. Potentially.
So, like, for example, you could be worrying about a legal issue for episode one, and you could be doing the base grade for episode three. So rather than waiting on legal for episode one, you're already moving ahead, plowing ahead. You've got a lot to do.
Right. It could actually be more efficient.
Yeah. And I do think the Netflix example is a good one in that the Netflix workflow is actually really kind of high end. Like, they're spending a lot of money on those shows. They're not holding back. So their workflow is probably more in line with what the primetime network shows are doing than what the reality cable shows are doing.
Right. I mean, I've never done a show even for Showtime or HBO or any of those, but it must be akin to how they do their stuff as well.
Yeah, I do think that there's some efficiency is going to be kind of a key factor, right? Like, what's the most efficient way of doing something? Because it really does. I mean, you know, ultimately, like, these shows have a finite amount. No matter what the schedule is, these shows have a finite amount of budget and time for doing X, Y, or Z. And so if you can do X, Y, or Z and A and B in that time period, then you have a value that you can offer beyond just what they were expecting. And that has that has a real appeal.
Yeah, if you look at shows like Boardwalk Empire or Game of Thrones, they're like 12-hour movies now if you look at them.
Yeah, or I mean, Breaking Bad. Breaking Bad was like a 62-hour movie. You know what I mean? Like, over the course of 6 seasons, it's a story that develops. But they weren't delivering all 62 hours at once. Where the guys doing Netflix are delivering 13 hours at once. But I do think there's something really... to me, as a colorist, there's something really appealing about that, because it means that you can think about an overarching story and style, and you can develop that over the course of 13 hours, as opposed to thinking about just this one episode. And I think you saw some of that in like with regards to color. I think you saw some of that in Breaking Bad, where you saw the kind of the palette develop and the characters sort of develop over the course of the series, and it really paid off at the end of the series in a really kind of compelling way. But it was something that, you know, the creator was thinking about and maybe telling the colorists about. Colorists, plural. I think there were more than one. And over the course of the series, it wouldn't be something that would be possible, I think, if the creator and the executive producers didn't have that mindset and that kind of creative input, where if you're delivering something on the in the format like Netflix, like if you're delivering something like House of Cards and you're delivering all 13 shows at once, or the new Arrested Development or whatever, you can have that input from somebody like a colorist that can say, what if we try this, and show them from this scene in the first episode through this scene in the 13th episode, here's what we can do to set the tone and develop it, you know, over the course of the series. And that's something that's really kind of exciting, I think, that long-form storytelling is really kind of interesting.
Do you guys think that with efficiency being really important, but the fact that the tools that we're dealing with are getting better and better, do you think that there's a situation where grading in the NLE will go away, or will it become stronger?
I think those two disciplines really require different tool sets. I think the model that Autodesk has sort of been teasing a little bit, of the idea of a machine that has editing capability that can be tied into either a software or another machine that can do dedicated color, and that those two things can be going on simultaneously and interchangeably, has a lot of appeal. I think Baselight is kind of modeling that with their plugin and BLG system, where they've basically got the ability for a hero colorist, to do a look for and a grade for a shot, send the BLG back with the shot, and have the editor load the BLG, and then be able to update that BLG and develop that BLG so you refine the grade, so that the grading process can happen in conjunction with the editorial process, not after or immediately before the editorial process. I think that's really appealing. I think the idea of a rolling conform, where it's not just, there's no lock, it's just what the current cut is, like let's update the cut, is critical. Like, it's critical in DI already, but I think in television it's going to become really critical. I think Resolve has a nice position on that, with the Resolve 10 having kind of that NLE finishing capability in the application, so you can keep updating the cut and just sort of fix the graphics when you need to, or fix the if you're doing reality TV, you might have to fix blurs or whatever. You can keep updating it and keep developing it. It doesn't have to be the idea of a locked cut has disappeared from our lexicon as colorists. Like, it doesn't really happen anymore. There's always one change. There's always one addition. There's always one shot removed. Like, that always happens. And so the tools need to adapt to that reality.
Yeah, and I would say the audio tools have improved in Avid and Symphony and all that, but yet we're still going out to Pro Tools to do final mixes as well. So are we going to stop going to a mix to get things done? No. So I have a feeling that we're probably going to stick with moving towards a grading and audio separation workflow.
So then it becomes really critical that, you know, interoperability is the thing. I mean, because I agree with you. I think that the idea of, you know, I think Pro Tools or dedicated audio mix is definitely going to remain important. And then color grading, it's interesting. It just depends on how far you want to take it. So, for instance, in Symphony, you can do a very nice job. If you were to go out to Resolve and you deal with those conform issues, you can do an even better job. I just wonder if the efficiency that's being asked for can sort of be given based on the fact that a lot of, you know, how do I put it? I see really nice inroads that Premiere CC is making. You know, I think Final Cut 10 has a really interesting angle going on where there's a lot of color tools coming out for it. You know, and so I take a look at these items as sort of maybe breadcrumbs toward where we're headed. And the thing that I wonder is, like, you know, in my own mind, and I'll say that this is just me, I constantly wonder if the truth of the matter is, you know, multi-app integration or the super app. And, you know, I've told other people I really like the idea of a super app, but there's a situation where the super app is difficult because implementing those tools in one interface is difficult. And also you've got a situation where when you get to a certain level of scale, you really just need that focused talent in each area. You know, the thought that as you go toward the high end, there's going to be that separation of skill sets. And then toward the low end, there might be these really capable, you know, NLEs that incorporate a number of plugins or features that allow people to do it at once.
I think there's a real value in like the separation of skill sets. I think the reason people go to a Pro Tools session is not because not just because the tools are different, but also because the operator is different. And you need someone with a good ear and an understanding of audio to do a mix, and you need someone with a good eye and an understanding of color to do timing. Like those two things go hand in hand. And I think actually what I'm seeing is the more editors start doing grading in the NLE, the more they realize how valuable it can be to do it well, you know, and how hard it is to do it well, and that it's a skill. Same thing with doing a rough mix in the NLE. You know, the more an editor, the more time, you know, an editor spends doing a rough mix in an NLE, that's time that they're not doing something else with, and it's work that's kind of like, you know, not really a rewarding job for them because it's kind of just scratch, right? I think with color, you know, you're going to see more and more of that. What the holy grail is, the kind of the ability to have both things happening simultaneously, so that a colorist is able to work on the grade, you know, while the edit is still in flux. And that's much harder with audio, and they haven't really worked on developing those kind of workflows with audio. You know, having an updated audio session, I think, is much trickier than having an updated color session.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think one of the other things too that color is dealing with is the fact that, you know, Pro Tools has been around as a widespread, you know, highly available tool for a long time, whereas color grading applications have been available, you know, let's say to the general public, you know, for, let's say, the past, you know, 4 or 5 years, you know, and even only recently, I think a lot of people are sort of diving in. So I think in 10 years, the clarity that we have with the fact that, you know, discrete audio mix is really critical will probably show through with color as well, you know. But I think also there were a lot of people who are just coming out of the rubble of, well, we didn't grade at all before, or, you know, we just did something very technical but not very creative. And so it's kind of that idea that, you know, people have to care about the idea of a better product to a certain extent, whereas there's that classically proven idea that, you know, what do they say? You know, the hardest part of video is audio. So if the audio mix is not quite good, that'll bring down a whole project, regardless of how good it is visually. You know, we have that same sort of constraint with color grading, but I do believe that people need to, you know, get their own exposure to what's possible and how much better things get when you do a really nice color grade on something, even if it's something in the past that could have gotten away without a tremendous amount of color grade other than, let's say, something technical. I think people will start to rapidly move on to the pile of that it's a requirement and not just something we're doing because we care more.
with TV, nothing is really cut and dry with any of this stuff either. So it's always complicated. It's always a deadline. It's always something. So, but as those deadlines loom, I'm going to jump back into mine. So I will close out by saying I'm Josh Petock, colorist in Los Angeles. You can find me on Twitter at Josh Petock or at my website, www.joshpetock.com.
And I'm Jason Myris, also a colorist in Los Angeles. You can catch me on Twitter at Jason Myris or on LiftGam again, where we'll be talking about this and other topics.
And I'm Juan Salvo, colorist in New York City. And you can find me at actually my new DI facility, the Color Space. That's with a U. That's the colour.com or juansalvo.com and on Twitter at J_Salvo. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.